Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
This is Andrew Horowitz. You know, here's the problem. I hear people that say all the time that they feel kind of chained to their office computer, you know? They spend hours and hours stuck in traffic just to get to their office PC. I know I do it a lot. Stay in the office late at night and never really any time for friends and family. Well, if this sounds like your life, try GoToMyPC. It lets you take your office with you wherever you are and wherever you go. So here's what you can do. You can definitely be more productive from home or anywhere. All you have to do is log on to gotomypc.com at your office desktop, and it instantly appears. Your whole office is right there in front of you. You can use any program, work on a file, check email, and access the networks of your choice. You know, anything that you have in your remote folders or your defined areas that you have on your PC at the office, right from your laptop at home or wherever you are. Here's what you can do. You can try GoToMyPC free for 30 days. But you must visit gotomypc.com/podcast. That's gotomypc.com/podcast for a free 30-day trial. You'll be happy you did. And hello and welcome. This is Andrew Horowitz, and it is episode number 107 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Really happy you're with me. Really happy that we have this opportunity each week to come on and chat about what's happening in the world of finance. So happy that you have chosen us to listen to. So listen, I got lots to talk about. I have decided to bring on two great individuals. Frank Herzia, who I got to tell you something, love Frank. He's with TheStreet.com. He has a great newsletter called Stocks Under $10. And he has a podcast that you've probably all listened to. And he's become a real good friend of mine. We share a lot of time together talking quite often on the phone. And I thought we would kind of, you know, some of the things we've talked about offline, I wanted to bring on and talk about online. And I also have a gentleman who's with the, I wanted to bring on an economist and talk about some of the recent concepts that have been brought to the front. Like, for example, how is it that the entire world is in a recession at the same time? Kind of weird, I think. You know, it kind of debunks the whole idea of true diversification, utilizing not only industries and sectors, but global diversification is right out the window. I mean, you can't do it when you see an environment that we've currently witnessed where everything is working in lockstep, not only the markets, but also the economies. We are seeing a few, of course, come out of the chute towards the recovery phase a little bit earlier. We see actually one country that has not entered, one major, I should say, has not entered into a recession at all at this point and is questioning whether or not they're ever going to. And we'll I'll talk about that in a little while. I have a gentleman who is with the Federal Reserve Board of St. Louis, Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, and he is going to chat with us as well. Now, let's get to some other business here. I got a lot of emails last week, and thank you very much, saying that last week with the gentleman from Zero Hedge and Mish was one of the most shocking podcasts we've had so far. I don't know. I don't know if it was shocking. I think it was interesting. You know, we're getting a lot of different I guess right now what's happening is where the market is in the recovery phase. We're getting a tremendous amount of polarity right now when it comes to those that think we're on the cusp of the next move higher, and those that are thinking this is just bogus, there's no way this is going to continue, it has to move down to the depths of the lows again, and you know, we're nowhere out of the woods. Green shoots are all over the place, and that concept of recovery has been, you know, continuing to, you know, shine upon us in the economic sense. And of course, you know, we need a strong economy before companies can really start profiting and doing well again. Right now, many companies, as a matter of fact, we did a study, it shows that approximately well, first of all, there's a good amount of EPS beats that are happening this earnings season, right? If you haven't noticed, That's what's happening. We're seeing EPS beats. The analysts' estimates are being beaten by about 10% on average. And I think it's about a 2-to-1 beat versus failure or a shortfall as compared to analyst expectations. We talked about this some time ago with a professor from Stern School of Business, I believe it was, where analysts will actually undercut the level of expectations in a down and a bad and a recession, depression, a market condition as we've seen now in a slowdown. And they will actually overshoot in the good times. So we kind of got to take that happy medium and say, okay, you know, we know things are really bad. Analysts are on total, on average, are probably going to underestimate. So that's what's happening right now, because when you look at revenues, what you're finding is revenues are very, very much in line with the expectations, which was significantly lower. We're seeing about a 35% reduction in earnings from quarter over quarter, and it's expected to be about 25% additional reductions over the next two quarters, possibly seeing a recovery towards a positive momentum, which is positive off the bottom, unfortunately. That's just the facts. In about the, I got approximately 3-4 quarters from right now. So where does that put us with the stock market? It looks like we're at the top of the range or close to. And there's some very interesting technical components that are actually coming up right now that you need to pay attention to. As a matter of fact, you need to be very, very careful this week that's coming up. I'll tell you why. We have a whole host of technical indicators that are flashing what we would call exhaustion on the markets. And we're seeing this kind of this mood that has been, I would best describe it as mildly optimistic, but yet concern is growing dramatically after we saw a 6-week or so interval where there was no downs overall on the S&P 500 on a weekly basis from week to week. And we had that one break, and then this week we just squeezed it out, and I know it looked better, but it was really the last hour of the trading day on Friday that pushed it over that 875 close that everybody's looking for, and now we're standing about 877. It was a tough ride to get to that point. This week, though, we have the stress test coming out on Thursday. Now, they changed the stress tests from Monday, I believe it was Monday, to Thursday. Now, why'd they do that? Here's my best guess. My best guess is now we're finding that initially there was two or three, or as Timothy Geithner would say, the vast majority of banks were just no problem not needing capital. Well, all of a sudden, we're seeing numbers like 12 and 13 companies, banks, may need to have capital infusions or changing of their capital structure or some kind of help to bring their tier one levels and their overall required, we'll call it reserve levels, back to where they need to be in order to meet the new stress test guidelines, which frankly, as we've talked about in the last episode, are not as stringent as maybe they could be. What's interesting to note is why they push it back. The first thing they're mentioning is that they're seeing that a lot of the banks they're troubled. They're concerned with the results. So they're appealing the results because nobody wants to come out and say that they are requiring to have further capital infusions. You know, right now there's a number that's floating around for Bank of America that they need about $60 billion. Citibank, Citicorp, Citigroup needs about $10-plus billion. Those are not small numbers. In fact, Bank of America's number, if it is true, is its entire capitalization right now. The market cap of Bank of America is about $55 billion, give or take the day. And if they need $50 or $60 billion to prop themselves up, I mean, that's an entire, I mean, why not just make a new bank? That's what we're dealing with. There's a couple of banks, they say, you know, J.P. Morgan, maybe Wells, potentially, clearly a Goldman, as they're saying, everybody's saying the same thing over and over, that, you know, these are names that don't need any money. They don't need anything. They're doing just fine. Well, they keep on bringing money in. Don't forget, Goldman just had a $5 billion infusion. They sold a lot of bonds recently. So, you know, these banks don't have as much problem getting private financing. Nobody wants to be on that list, though, and that's a big concern for next week. There's going to be a lot of volatility there, a lot of confusion, I fear. Now, I'm not calling for just, you know, broad-based, you know, trashing, but I got to tell you something. There's no reason to be in front of this, right? I mean, you want to be in front because we want the profits and all that if things go well, but you know what? We've seen the run, the anticipation, the expectation. Right now, be disciplined. Sit on your hands a little bit. Wait till we see what the fallout's going to be. One of the things that we're doing for our portfolios is we're looking at starting to build back up just a small amount of a hedge through this week. Just this week. We don't want to, you know, lose dramatically if things turn around and we see all of a sudden a drop off. We are in an interesting phase, as I mentioned, where things are lining up till about Tuesday or Wednesday of next week. There's a variety of technical indicators that are getting to a crossing stage. Some very sophisticated ones that are not usually used, and institutions use these. And some of these are the traditionals. But basically, what we're seeing is that Tuesday, Wednesday, and that's interesting because that's the day the stress test is coming out. We're also seeing, you know, additional earnings coming out throughout the week. And at the back end of the earnings, we're seeing weakness, more weakness than we saw on the front end. In other words, the banks were looking great with the mark-to-market changes, and they really had a good run there. But right now, what we're seeing is a real concern in moving into next week. And then I think the final point here is, why do they move it to Thursday? The potential is that we're going to see a little bit better of an employment number come out Thursday, and that would be used to kind of, you know, soften the blow of whatever the banking information is that's coming out. Think about it. I mean, there's a lot of, we'll call posturing that goes on a continual basis from the Fed, the Treasury, and the government. Okay, that's fine. They need to do that because, you know, without their, you know, seeing things positively into the future, you know, people could be, you know, investors really could be very nervous. So I think the posturing that's going on right now is to try their best to soften the blow somehow. And if, in fact, they have a little bit of an advanced thought on where the employment numbers are going to be, unemployment possibly ticking to about 8.8, 8.9% overall. We saw the continuing claims numbers tick up, as well as the 6 handle on the initial claims last week. So I think that overall, you know, we have to be very careful here. Now, one of the things I want to do is, we're going to get to this discussions in a second. I want to let you know a couple of things that you know, need to know. First of all, if you haven't checked it out, the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy, I think we're, since inception last July, about 32 or 33% ahead of the S&P 500. We don't really use that as a benchmark. We use that as kind of a viewing of where things are. If you want to check out what that's all about, if you want to look at how we do things, how we use our Quanta Fund Techna strategy to actually, you know, soften the downside and do our best to enhance returns over the long term, well, go check it out on the website. There is a 14-minute video that you could check out that takes you right through all that. There's also an Introduction to Horowitz & Company video at horowitzandcompany.com. I'd also encourage you, this is a great time right now. Right now, we're on the cusp of either this kind of movement of the market, either a bit higher, which would be a little bit difficult to do right now considering the economics and the earnings issues that are right here right now. But again, optimism is pushing things pretty far. But one of the great things you could do right now is study up on technical analysis and fundamental analysis, understanding what's under the hood. Go over to Amazon, pick up the book, $13. You'll get yourself a great book, a quick read. You'll really understand a lot of things better. The Disciplined Investor, I'm sure that you'll find a few little nuggets in there that you could use. And like I said, at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, but really cheap over there. And I'll have some announcements on some other things that are happening that are very interesting. I think you'll be interested in next week. Last thing is that I want to mention to you is that we're going to start doing a Friday stock screens on the website, The Disciplined Investor. So check that out. There's always a lot of news that we put up there. We're going to start putting some screens and the results of like GARP and highest dividends and maybe the banks with the highest or lowest tier one capital. And we'll look at things like some famous, you know, companies that could really benefit from some of the green shoots, if you will, and economic expansion issues and wind power. We'll have those throughout the next few weeks, and we'll continue that. People have asked us about our screening process. We'll show you what we did to get there, some of the dynamics of what the components are, and then we'll post the screen so you can take a look at those for trading ideas. And the last thing I want to mention is this is important because I'm going to be at the Las Vegas Money Show, or the money show that's happening in Las Vegas, and that's going to be happening in the second week of May. And if you can get there, I'd love to meet you. And if you can't get there, they're going to be simulcasting actually my session, and I'll put that information so you have the direct link and you can see it. I think it's on May 11th. But you can see that right on your computer, and I'll be simulcasting the session that we're going to be doing. It's going to be on portfolio mastery and some technical analysis points. We're going to talk about some of the recent finer details of some technical analysis and our Quanta Fund Techna, but kind of get under the hood of that. And I think it's going to be a good session. We'll talk about some things that are really going to be breaking out next session and why commodities may be a real benefit. So if you can get there, that would be great. I'd love to meet you. And if not, well, you can do it virtually. We'll put all that information on the website, on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. We'll make sure to have that there. And then everybody that is on the mailing list will get that as well, okay? Okay, so stick around. We'll be right back. The Disciplined Investor Podcast. Actually, we're here with Frank Curzio from thestreet.com. Also, he has a wonderful newsletter. It's called Stocks Under 10, and that's available. We'll find out in a minute how we get a handle on that. But I thought it would be kind of cool to talk about in this world that everything seems all right, and it seems that we have a lot of cheer going on right now, my friend.
Yes, it does. Thank you. I like being on this show. I love you, man.
Hey, what's going on, man? So, you know, you have a great show. You're a great podcast. You bring on all – you and I talk about offline a lot how – one of the things that you did was that you love about your podcast is that you brought on people that a lot, this is what you say, a lot smarter than you, so that you can find out a lot about what's going on. So what's the kind of pulse out there? What's going on?
The pulse is, I have to say, I think that there's a bias towards being bullish. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know as well as I do that they just don't want this market to go down. The government. I mean, if it does come down, it seems like they change the rules. It's very tough for research guys like you and myself, where, you know, you look at some of these financials, and you know how bad they are. They come out today with the stress test results, which was really last night, but really getting more details today, that now six banks are probably not going to pass the stress test. So now you see that Bank of America needs to raise more money, Citigroup needs to raise more money. We already knew this, but these stocks have gone up tremendously. E-Trade, a company that's not even people, they do have the best platform. If you look at it, it's great, but they're a mortgage company. They bought all that real estate at the top, and then we're talking about risky, the top subprime. And now the stock was $1, and it went over $3, but then they come out today and say, well, we're going to have to raise a tremendous amount of money, and we're going to dilute the shareholders, and the stock crashes today down 30%. So you look at the fundamentals, and you see that. But sometimes there's a disconnect with the stocks what's going on. It's very difficult to really go in and I don't like using the term all in, but really buying stocks here because the fundamentals don't make sense. But based on trading, based on the technicals, it seems like these stocks are definitely going to go higher.
Well, that's an interesting point that you bring up there because this has been the conundrum, hasn't it? This has been an unbelievable conundrum. You know, on one hand, the fundamentals, if you would have followed the fundamentals, you would have probably stayed away from a lot of terrifying issues. Let me restate that. If you would have followed the fundamentals and incorporated the technicals at the same time, there was a way back, I'm talking a year ago or so, there was something happening that didn't seem to work. There was something happening that was showing that there was this kind of market condition that didn't smell right, didn't feel right. The kind of, they weren't matching. Well, we have the same thing on the opposite now, but the opposite way. The technicals have clearly, obviously, you look at a chart, from the low to the high, and obviously it looks really very tantalizing. But you look at a chart from the high to the low, it tells a whole different story on the long-term trend.
Yes, and you have to be aware the fundamentals do matter. I mean, those old numbers and the balance sheets and 10-Ks, they do matter, as you see with E-Trade. So just be careful, and if you're up a lot of money, there's nothing wrong with taking profits. And when I say take profits, don't take everything off the table because this market can go up. We can go up 9,000 on the Dow, even though unless IBM and Exxon go up as well, we're not going to see that because they're the major components and it's a price-weighted index, not really an indication of what the market's doing. But even if we go up a lot higher, who knows where the market's going to go? You definitely want to be in it. Don't be afraid to take profits, especially with my Stocks Under 10 newsletter. Sometimes I speak and talk to my audience at the Real Story podcast from someone who manages the Stocks Under 10 newsletter, and a guy that's been in this industry for 3 years looking at biotech companies that weren't profitable, hoping on a phase 3 drug, to looking at companies not 6 months ago about from Starbucks, Dell, GE, Western Digital, Massey, Ashland. I mean, this is the quality of companies that were in there. So looking from that point of view, and you're seeing the move on the Stocks Under 10 up to 300% on some of these stocks, you kind of say, okay, I need to take a step back. But then again, someone looking from as a large cap point of view might say, well, you know, this is it. We still have room to run. And you know what? It all matters when you got into this market. I became pretty bullish pretty much about 3 weeks before the market really started taking off. And I got hurt the first couple of weeks, yep. And I was nervous. I was one of those guys that was hiding under my desk. I'm not lying. And but if you got it at that time, you're looking at stocks now saying, you know what, hey, I'm looking to take profits. But the guy on the sideline right now, and that's a lot of guys on CNBC and Fox Business News and in the media who are on the sidelines, are just starting to get into this market after we just saw one of the greatest 7 to 8 week rallies in our history, in our lifetime, in a generation.
But let's wait, Frank.
Which is pretty scary for someone who's been in this market all along.
But you know what?
For a guy like me who's looking to sell here or take some profits, it's hard to get in.
Well, but you know what? On the other hand, let's just put the full picture together. Let's not even talk about 2008. Let's just talk about 2009. One of the greatest rallies after the greatest drops. Right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so it's not like just the greatest rally out of nowhere. It really was just a take back, a fill of the gap, if you will. during that time. And it's interesting because there's a different, it's very interesting because if you start out the year, okay, the year 2009, you know, with, you know, $100 and you invested all in the markets and you dropped down to $70, let's just say as a number, right? So, and then you came back to $100. You didn't get anywhere, right? Now, of course, you could have been a genius. You could have got in midway. You could have been out midway. You could have been whatever the function is there. But the fact is that right now, when we look at this, the euphoria that people are seeing is very much similar to the fear they were seeing totally flipped only a few weeks ago.
Yes. And, you know, and you bring up a great point. You bring up a great point. And here's what I see, and two different ways of looking at it. One is company Massey Coal that reported today. Lowered production guidance, said it's absolutely terrible. 2009, 2010 coal producer. And the stock's up 25%. Now you look at that and you say, well, why'd that happen? One, they're going to be, the analysts are looking at that, you know, the supply-demand curve is going to be now in balance. It's going to be good. They're one of the stronger players, have a liquidity position. The stock is down from $100, and it was 10. And in all fairness, this is one of the ones I was able to pick up in the stocks under 10 portfolio, and I've had some losers. I'm not pointing out just the winners here. But the stock went to about 12, 12.50 and ahead of the quarter, and I'm saying, wow, you know what, I'm putting this as a holdout, a small position. And you know what, the stock's up like another 25% on top of that. And to me, I'm looking at it saying, wow, you know, there's no way you could buy Massey Coal up here 50% on that quarter. And you're looking for this at the same thing when it comes to companies like Nucor, when it comes to companies like U.S. Steel, Caterpillar. I mean, the outlooks for these companies have been so terrible, it makes you think that it couldn't have been any worse. So you almost have to buy ahead of the quarter. Now, I don't really know if I want to go with that strategy.
That's a mouthful. That's a mouthful. I got to tell you something. And that's what's happening, by the way, right?
So now, that's what's happening, but and you can't really buy ahead of the coin. I mean, it's a coin flip, but if you really think that U.S. Steel was going to lower their earnings estimates for next year by 50%, 250 to $1.25, and the stock was going to go up on that, then, I mean, what could be actually worse? That's why it tells you, like, before the unemployment report, maybe you should be buying, which makes absolutely no sense. I'm just saying what people are thinking out there, because how worse is it going to be? And if it stabilizes, it seems like it's going to go up. And how worse is it going to be? We're going to hit 700,000, 9% right now. I don't think we'll hit 9%. And right away, it seems like it's going to be spun into, okay, this is, you know, it's not going to get much
worse. Don't forget, if we did hit 9%, if we did hit a 7 handle, or let's go crazy, okay? Let's go crazy.
Okay.
Let's say we hit a 1 million handle on the next unemployment number. Okay? That's crazy. It's not happening, obviously, but I'm just speculating and going into la-la land. Right now, the spin would be that that would be the crescendo, and that's the time to buy. Seriously.
Absolutely. No, that's the way.
If we hit 400, they were right that things are getting better. So, in other words, you can't go wrong here. And I'm not suggesting you should, by the way. I just find this really interesting. It's fascinating, the change in psychology.
On you. If it comes in at 500, that's going to be taken as a positive. 500,000 job losses. That's a positive. That's insane.
Well,
that's the way. That's the market we're in right now.
The trouble is, you know what? Maybe you can confirm this for me. The trouble is that a strategy that relies on anything other than just closing your eyes right now and putting it in, any research on things is really not going to work so well.
No, well, I wouldn't really go that far, because I think if you really do your homework, especially during earnings season, and let me point out real quick an example. There's a company called Prexel, CRO provider. They're a contract research organization where a lot of large pharmaceuticals farm out their work and you know, it saves some costs, like outsourcing. And this company fell 30%, pretty much below $8, on news related to a competitor. Mm-hmm. And that was Kendall that warned and said cancellations of 45%. Then Goldman Sachs came out and did their thing, added one of the leaders to their conviction sell list. That means, I guess, they really don't like the stock. But and the whole industry came down. Now, here's a stock that, you know, that's a good starting point going in. It's one of the stocks that we looked at. Again, one of the ones I'm going to see I'm benefited on, but I did have losers in the portfolio. I don't want to just point out the winners. And this is a company where you're looking at down 30% on news unrelated to itself. Then you look at the balance sheet, not too bad, but you look at the insiders were buying a little bit higher, so you're starting to get to the homework. You look at the valuation. It's one of the cheapest ones in the space. And, you know, I hate buying stocks ahead of the quarter, and it's something I wouldn't do, but it's down 30%. So looking from a risk-reward perspective, it looks like you're seeing 10% downside risk if they miss. If they report in line, the stock's probably going to go up. And if they have positive guidance, it's going to surge. Well, they have positive guidance, and it worked out. So expectations, I think, are a big deal. Mm-hmm. Right now, if you're looking at financials, expectations are through the roof. Even though Bank of America and Citigroup just said, hey, you know what, $70 billion? They're going to need to raise. I mean,
do you realize that the GDP report, they were all aflutter over a drop of $111 billion worth of inventory. $111 billion drop of inventory drawdowns. In other words, the concept is that when you have inventories in businesses, and we say that the inventories went down by $111 billion, you can look at it two ways. Number one, they're selling it, which they're not. What's happening is they're just, well, they are, I shouldn't say that. They are selling it, but they're not replacing it. That's what's happening there.
Well, that's a thesis. They're going to eventually replace it, which is going to lead to demand.
Right, which you know, in this environment, they're probably, they're definitely going to replace it, by the way, because of demand, not to get demand. So here's it's kind of a cycle. I guess I shouldn't say that. The manufacturing cycle starts off with making it, but you have to buy the raw materials, and it goes through the whole cycle. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting is, now I want to put that in perspective. $110 billion was the inventory drop, which was the greatest drop in modern times in terms of inventories. Mm-hmm. And $70 billion is the Bank of America possible requirement. That's unbelievable.
I mean, if you really look at the GDP data, it's also going up because of the positive increase in consumer spending, which we were expected to have a jump from last month's numbers anyway. It's 2.2% increase. But you need to break down the data a little more. It was mostly due to durable goods, which is cars, and there's huge incentives on cars. It's furniture and appliances. And those are like the three keys to the consumer spending component that went higher. And if you're looking at interest rates being lower, you're seeing a temporary move into housing. I think the people on the sidelines finally are saying, okay, interest rates are low, home prices are low, plus they get a tax credit. Let me jump right in there, but I really do believe that that's only temporary. And going forward, and not to mention this dumb number is going to get revised three more times, and it's going to be 2% off of what it is now. So, you know, I don't know how much you want to read into it anyway, but it's still negative 6% on GDP, much worse than expected. And for us to be up like this, it's almost amazing. Maybe we should just buy, because it just seems like the more negative the numbers come out, the more positive it is for stocks sometimes.
You know, that sounds silly.
I know. It's absolutely insane. But, you know, on the flip side, there are some great opportunities out there. I want the market to work. I want the Obama plan to work. Mm-hmm. I still haven't seen anyone come up with a plan of how we're going to pay this money back. And we're not seeing the negative implications that happen when we decide to print a ton of money.
Wait.
Trillion in 22 months.
You know what, though? Amazingly, in part of the GDP, just to go back to that, we did see a pickup in the consumer component, and that has to be, if you're going to look for reasons why something's happening, like, you know, we're doing, that has to be because of the excessive amount of money that's being pushed into the economy. It has to be.
And not only that, people got their taxes done early this year. Consumers are struggling. I mean, those are facts. They're getting that money's being filtered in maybe to the last month of that GDP figure, but that's another thing to consider. And again, we all want this to work, and we want stocks to go higher, but there's some stocks, especially in under 10 land, that have no business being where they are. And even some of the ones that I own that have holes that have taken profits, you know, I'm just sitting there going, wow, this stock just keeps running. I'm going to hold my small position. You know, I took profits two different times, which I happen to be dead wrong. I should have held the full position. But I think we need a little bit of pullback in certain stocks, and there are still a lot of opportunities out there as well. But to come on here and you know, as so many people we see in the media, they give, well, what's your forecast for you know, the S&P 500? Who cares? Who cares?
Well, it's interesting
you
mentioned
that. There's a lot of great individual opportunities out there you should be taking advantage of. It's not going to be as easy as it was the past 8 weeks, but there are a lot of great opportunities. Listen to the conference calls during earnings season. You get a leg up.
You know what's also interesting is, and I don't know if you want to confirm this or deny this, but I've had the experience on this podcast several times to have people come on and be, you know, I don't want to say bullish, but, you know, quite either bullish or whatever, but then offline they say a different story.
You know what? I'm just a realist. I'll be honest with you. There's no bullish, no bearish. Right. I call it how I see it.
No, hey, don't understand, Frank. I didn't say you said that. I'm not saying you, and you're not. You're straight up. Listen, we talk all.
Oh, absolutely.
What do we talk every day? You and I talk every day, right?
Yeah.
So, and when we were kind of banging our heads on different things, whining about different things, and cheering on other things, right? Mm-hmm. But the fact of the matter is that you know, so many people are kind of coming on and doing things, whether it's on TV, or whatever. They say one thing and then talk one way, and then on the other way, it's kind of a different discussion. And I just wonder where the real meets the...
Yeah, I don't know.
I just wonder where the real meets the, you know, the pavement and kind of combines. Let me ask you this. So stocks under $10. You have this great newsletter. You put out, you know, kind of recommendations and talk about what things. You have a lot greater universe now in 2008 and 2009 than you did really ever before, because the stocks under 10 are a different caliber. Let's say that, right?
Absolutely.
So how
good
do you,
balance sheets.
How do you go about doing your research for that? Kind of take us through that, because a lot of people that are listening are trying to learn, right? So what do you do? How do you start the day with looking for things?
Not even start the day, and it's amazing because I've been asked this question a lot. It's a top-down approach. It's not bottoms up, it's top down. It's bottoms up after you figure out what sectors you think are going to benefit. Being able to see the home builders, a lot of home builders at under 10 in the past 3 months. I would not recommend one individual home builder, but the ETF, which is the XHB, was around $10.
Yep.
Figuring it would go up to 13, 14, and so far we're there. It's probably going to go even higher. We're going to see positive statistics on housing. I know I don't own a house. I'm in the market to buy a house.
Right.
I rent.
Right.
And I know that it's not near a bottom now, and the people who call a bottom are probably millionaires who have three homes that really don't understand the market. And, everyone who does call a bottom, I say, you know what, have people email you. You see what's really going on in the real world. And you'll get, a ton of emails telling them how difficult it is.
Are you talking about a bottom in terms of price and bottom in terms of
Thing, too. People don't even want to call a bottom in price. There's not a bottom in pricing when it comes to housing right now. I don't think it's affordable, especially when you have to put down 20% down payment and you're seeing unemployment rising.
I just ran a number just 2 days ago, and I looked at what's called the Housing Affordability Index.
Take it and throw it out.
Why should we throw it out?
Because it's not a good indication.
I understand.
One, it does include the 20% down payment. It doesn't include unemployment.
Right,
it doesn't include how much it costs to really go into a house, to buy new furniture for a home. It doesn't include property taxes that are going to be raised for the next 15 years, and I'm probably being conservative on that number with the amount of spending we're having. So it's a number that does not make sense. It doesn't account for credit. Which is pretty much very, very bad right now, which I know you know because you've been looking at some of the credit card companies and how bad credit is right now, the tightening credit market. So it doesn't include that. It doesn't mean people are going to jump out there and buy a home because right now that affordability index is at the lowest point, I want to say, ever, according to statistics. Then how come no one's buying homes right now? So it's not an accurate gauge of people
buying
homes.
It's interesting because I throw that out to you, by the way, with a little bit of a question behind it and kind of maybe a loaded question. And that was that, this is like many of the statistics we're seeing now, though. You can't trust all of them. I'm not saying that so anybody is intentionally. Now they're trying to debunk the entire Case-Shiller. Did you see this? They're trying to say that it's totally, bogus using the Case-Shiller home, all the different numbers, the 10, 20s.
See, that's one of the ones I think that has been the most accurate.
I agree.
I mean, people are spinning that into a positive because it didn't hit a record, but it barely didn't hit a record. And I think half of the 20 cities in that index did hit records, including Phoenix and a couple of others. But I think that's more of an accurate gauge than some of the other home statistics that seem to fluctuate, a lot more, like existing and new home sales.
I agree. No, I mean, it was a year over year. Just came in a few days ago, and it was almost equal to the one prior. In terms of the pricing, and everybody was all excited, and it's interesting. The if you look at the Economist magazine this month, there is this glimmer of hope cover with this. It's an anglerfish, if you can imagine that, with a little light at the end of its head, kind of dangling like a little piece of bait, and all these little guppies coming around and thinking, oh, here's some hope for us, and obviously going to be swallowed up by the big fish. And that's the kind of hopeful thing, green shoots discussion, because here's the deal, and here's what I think a lot of people are getting caught up in, and by the way, I don't think this is bad. We have been generally bearish on the economy, okay?
Mm-hmm.
That translates into bearishness longer term, or I should say midterm, we'll call it. I don't want to say long term, but midterm on certain sectors of the stocks. And very surprised, frankly, and I've talked to you this, very surprised on how rapidly this market has gone up, and not only gone up, but sustained itself. That's the second part. It's quite amazing to me today. And I don't think you disagree either. It's amazing how fast this market came up after so many people have been burned.
And it has come up pretty fast. I just think we're due for a pullback. And remember the Dow, and I like to use the Dow because that's a measure that measure is the S&P. But sometimes a more familiar is with the Dow, which is at 14,000, and it's still what is it at 8,100 after today 8,200, and it's still come down considerably. But again, you don't want to see kind of a straight line up. And I know we've been trading a little bit sideways over the past week and a half or so, but you really want to see some of these stocks come in a little bit better. But the good news is every time they do come in, it seems like there's additional buying coming in.
Yeah, but they haven't come in very much. I mean, we have not seen a reasonable, healthy, I'll say healthy, pullback. And that doesn't mean things are going to go bad. Not at all. But it's just kind of like when you've seen this over the years and you've seen markets over the years, and although we haven't seen this kind of market over the last 2 years, it would just seem like, I would just say the word logical, which maybe is the problem here. It would be logical to see that. So let's talk about earnings for a second. We've been running some numbers on a regular basis on the S&P 500 and the overall U.S. markets. Couple things. First of all, Japan. Any comments on Japan?
On Japan, I'm not a big favorite of Japan. No, are you a favorite of Japan? I forgot last time I spoke to you. I know you're a favorite of China, right?
China has been very positive on China, and you know, some of the emerging markets. We have a nice position in Brazil. We have a nice position in India. China, we kind of went out of at the peak recently. We were thinking about getting back in here. We ran it up, and then remember how it came down about 10% in like 4 days or something of that nature.
I love all everything that you love. I love.
Yeah,
no,
China. I mean, Japan. Japan. The PE.
Japan. I'm worried. I mean, it just seems like they can't get their act together. You have a place that's seeing negative population growth. The stories I read, the research I do, just says, hey, you know what? You should stay away from that region. Still, I know a lot of people are picking it. Now, switching to China, I might be a little bit more bearish than you. I mean, they reported 6.1 GDP. They have low unemployment. They have a housing bubble. And these are from stats that I get from people that actually live there. And, yeah, it just doesn't make sense. Lower industrial production. And I know that stimulus plan filters right in, like, immediately. But it didn't make sense, the numbers. And I wish, I don't know, I think, you know, maybe we're probably going to see GDP rise. I mean, everyone's raising their estimates from Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley for China. But, again, we have to realize that market has run up considerably. And you've been bullish on China for a while and been dead right.
Yeah,
so far,
I've been right. You know, the thing is that there's two different investments on China. One's the Hong Kong area that you can really get into, the FXI, which is the Hong Kong
not a good gauge, right? The FXI.
It hasn't been
ETFs
great.
Are a lot better,
yeah, it hasn't
right
been great. Well, it's been good for Hong Kong, of course. It's been right on for Hong Kong. But it hasn't been it's been good. I mean, really good. But it hasn't been, you know, the stupendous one. There's a couple other ones. There's one that's a closed-end fund with low liquidity that's really been very accurate. But with low liquidity, man, it's always you got to wonder about that in terms of low volume. So Japan, yeah, I agree with you. Japan is, the PE ratios are out of control. It's like everybody's throwing their money in. And the one thing I think they're getting a giant rise out of is the fact that they think that the car manufacturers in the U.S. are going out of business, which from day to day, who knows if that's true. And they're going to get a big, you know, they'll get a nice tick on that. So just to get back, so we do a top-down. I'm going to kind of return to the analysis.
Oh, okay. It's top-down at the beginning. I try to look at different sectors, if it's going to be retail or I see consumer spending picking up in the short term, whatever it is. And then you go into like the bottoms up and you look at individual companies within the sector. One of the things I do look at, and no one data point, I look at all of these, and I'll give you like quick examples. Insider buying, I don't like to see a stock, and most stocks, even though they've rallied, they're down considerably. I mean, even Massey Energy down from nearly 100 to 10. You don't want to see sellers. You don't want to see insiders selling. That's a big turnoff, and I don't want to hear that they want to diversify because CEOs are the greediest people in the world. That's not true. I want to see some sort of insider buying. You don't need to see it, but it's also it's attractive if you see 10 of your data points, and then you're like, wow, also insiders are buying stocks.
But Frank, let me just interrupt you. Insider buying. Right now, there's actually a statistic out that says that insider selling has peaked more than it's seen in a very, very long
absolutely
time.
Absolutely interesting stat.
Interesting stat. Okay, but again, we discount that.
Interesting stat, yeah. And you see the buy-sell ratings. If you look at companies, say, in a large cap level, Qualcomm, you guys get a chance to pull it up. I'll give you a free site, Yahoo Finance. I try to provide the information on my podcast. Qualcomm, Gilead, Apple, like 90% of the analysts covering those stocks, which is anywhere from 25 to 30, have buy ratings or strong buy ratings.
Right.
I like to see stocks that have no buy rating sometimes. And the stocks in the under 10 land, maybe you have 5, maybe 6, 7, 8 analysts covering it. It's nice to see only one or two, because if they do come out with a good quarter, you're going to see those upgrades and you're going to see the positive being reflected. And that could really, really, you know, push the company forward and really get momentum where, you know, companies like Panera Bread today, which came out with not too bad of a quarter, came down. I mean, it's a 2-week high. Expectations are built in. A lot of people optimistic. Another thing, valuation as well. You really want to look at it compared to your peers. You want to see where it's trading. And most important, listen to past conference calls, like the last two quarters. It'll give you an accurate gauge of what management's doing as it met their goals. And you can find those transcripts at free places. Just do a Google search and, you know, you guys can pull it up on your stock. But again, the homework's there for you to do. It's just a matter of putting in the time and doing it.
And the question also is for people to be careful. Don't, you know, you're not there just to take the data down and just believe it, of course. I mean, you got to kind of like assimilate it.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just because, okay, there's a buy rating. Okay, we're buying it. I mean, because those buy ratings could turn into a sell rating, obviously.
Absolutely. It could be overnight. So you really want to do your homework. And it's all about risk-reward. I mean, sometimes it's worth going into, you know, a crazy stock like Dendrion at 6, knowing that the cost is 0, but if Provenge gets approved, the stock's going to go to 24. I'm not saying 24 because it's there now. It was 24 when that drug was probably going to get approved, or they thought it was going to get approved last time. So that's the upside in the stock. Maybe it's worth buying at 5, but know that your risk is 0, and you're upside is 24. That's not great risk reward for everybody. People don't want to lose their whole entire money. But we know, you know, we see people all the time that have $10,000 they don't care about and say, listen, I want it to be, you know, triple or nothing or whatever. But that's an extreme example I'm giving you. But you want to identify the risk rewards just with certain companies where, okay, you want to make sure the risk that you're taking is worth it if you're wrong.
Yeah, I'm hearing you. I hear you. You know, it's interesting because Dendry and I happen to have done a podcast with Mike Huckman from over at CNBC, a year ago maybe, and we talked about Dendry on because I had some really good information about understanding about what was going on. There was a real interesting scandal involved in that one a year ago or so when they found out on the Fast Track program, but we could talk about that another day. Really fascinating discussion about the stock, not to mention what happened right before the announcement of the results of their trials where the stock dropped about 50%. Yeah. And the NASD or the NASDAQ, whoever it was, actually said, okay, you know what? We're going to keep the trades on, which was really fascinating. So you do the research, and you come up with, you know, the names. And again, you know, listen, let's kind of get back to something. You were hiding under your desk, right? I mean, there's not always good times. Mm-hmm. There's going to be some bad times. And that doesn't also mean hold on. I mean, you got to, every once in a while, you got to wonder, you know what? Not everything's going to go right into your portfolio. Mm-hmm. I mean, not everything's going to be going along with you. This is the fact of investing. And if you think that, let's be honest here, you know, some people are freaking out over a 5% loss or a 10% gain or a 20% loss. Everybody has their own level of risk, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So the question is, how much risk do you want to take? You know, and how long are you in the game for? Are you in the game for a week? Well, then you want to make 100% a week.
I'm not in the game for the week. That's for sure. Right. So the thing is, I think it's important to see the thesis or the reason why you came up for your stock pick. If that's still intact, what I like to do, this market is extremely, extremely volatile, is take a very small position off stocks that I like.
Right.
The worst case scenario is a stock runs. I own it. That's the worst case. If it comes lower, and it's coming lower, a company like Ashland, which I was early into, which I originally recommended at 10, went to 5. Hundreds of emails on it saying, what do you do, what do you do, what do you do? And, some people like to put a 25% stop loss, which is, that's okay if that's what you like to do. With Ashland, everything was intact. Every reason, all 10 reasons, whatever it was, insider buying, valuation, a cutting cost, had a large debt position, but they didn't have any significant debt due for the next 5 years. I stuck by my guns. I was able to average down all the way down. So I really didn't feel, as it was coming down, as it got down to like the $6 level, I kind of felt it. But it was a 2% position. I added 1.5 all the way down, got my cost basis down to 7. Stocks at 20 today. So it's a perfect example of something working out. However, on the other end, what happens if it goes to 4.3? You don't want to lose your whole investment. But a lot of times, that's the difficulty in managing a portfolio, which everybody has, where, okay, when do you throw in a towel? And it just turns out that most of the time when you throw in a towel, it's the worst time the stock's going to rise. But you have that.
Well, let me tell you something.
Your tolerance of risk.
Let me tell you what we did.
Frank,
let me tell you something. You know, we you and I have been talking about this, and one of the most troubling issues for us has been this. We totally avoided the downstroke in the markets, okay? Beautiful, right? Beautiful. The problem was that, the way we did that was because we danced a lot. We did a lot of dancing. I mean, you know, kind of something didn't work out our way, we were out of it quickly. People love that, you know? I mean, I love that because we didn't get hurt, you know, even though we had some excessive trading, so something worked, you get out of it. You know, the problem is the markets right now I find to be even more volatile than they were because they're not directionally volatile. The volatility that was way back when was kind of like down, let's say, right? Now there's no directional. Yes, it's up, don't get me wrong, but I'm saying it's very much back and forth directionally, okay? And the problem you have with that is that, you know, when you get into that situation and you're involved, and what we're so frustrated about is many of our positions and many of the things that we like, generally speaking, have been doing okay, right? But the problem is that I am not willing to take the volatility on the downstroke. So what that did was it kind of precluded us from getting a lot of the upside on much of this. And it's very, very frustrating.
On the upside, to be honest with you, I've been able to participate in the upside. I'm above my benchmark by about 17%. But the thing is I'm in an area of the market with stocks under 10 where you've seen these early cyclical plays really rise. So I was able to participate in that. And again, I didn't think these stocks would go as high as they did, and most of them holding on to, not telling you to buy at these levels. But I'm doing that well against my benchmark without having one financial. So it just goes to show you, I significantly reduced the amount of risk, but still trying to participate in that huge return. return. Granted, it's not as great as some of the, you know, some of these stocks individually, but it's again, I try to go between risk reward and really be able to adapt to the markets. It's very
so. What time frame are you talking about that you're ahead of your index? What's the time
for the year?
For this year?
For the year. Yeah, okay. For this year. I mean, my benchmark is the Russell. I'm about, I think, 11-12%.
The 2000. Russell 2000.
For this year.
No, I'm saying Russell 2000 is your benchmark.
The Russell 2000
is my benchmark. Cap, that's small cap stocks. There's the S&P 600, which is also the small caps. There's a few other small cap indices. It's interesting because over the last year and change, we're about 35% over our index.
So it was but that's what your that's what your
we're
client
thrilled.
Base wants to
we're thrilled
you
about know. That. The problem is over the last two
There's
months.
Nothing.
The last 2 months we're not. The last 2 months we're sucking wind.
If you listen, I really believe if you're going to manage your portfolio and look at it, you know, in a 2 month increments, you might as well just jump out the window now.
Hold on, hold on, hold on. Opening the latch right now.
It's very difficult. You know, you can't really look at your portfolio. I know it's hard to because, you know, you're watching CNBC and you know, these stocks are all over the place. But really, you're in this market for the next 20 years. Think of your family, think of your kids if people are out there.
I'm with you.
You know, you want to be a better provider for them. You don't want to go in there.
I watch our portfolios. I sit on our portfolios for our clients like a mother hen. Now, if you got in with the wrong time, if the exact wrong time with us, you know, in other words, where we started to go the wrong direction down, we're down 8%, I think it is, or so, give or take, on the worst case, right? You know, if you're with us this year, we matched the market. We're a little bit behind the market right now, depending on the timing of that. But again, it's the longer term. We will catch up. It's just that we're having some difficulty kind of adapting to some of this right now because we're just, our numbers are crossing. And
yeah, but it's
the long term of the game is long.
You've been making a ton of money for people. Yeah. They understand. You know, that's great. I've been talking to you for how long? Maybe about 4 months now. Yeah. And you know, half the stuff, more than half the stuff you give me. I mean, you've been dead right on. You have a great outlook on the market. I learned a lot from you from listening to you and talking to you. I love the contact we have. But again, you know, month by month, it's very difficult to manage portfolios month by month.
No,
and
I agree.
You know, like I know what you're feeling because I used to manage money, and clients call you month by month and say what's going on. But you know, it's just funny. What'd you do this month for me lately? But I think you know the long term perspective, and you know, want to have more money in your portfolio 10 years, 15 years from now. I think you know having that kind of outlook is more significant than looking at you know a 2 month performance where the government is just has its hand in every single business right now. Changing the rules, making sure that if the market goes down, they bring back the uptick rule. If it goes down, they're going to put more money into the banks. If it goes down, you know, just, you know, more liquidity. Just say what, you know, they're going to ban short selling again for the financials. It's amazing. It's such a positive bias. And the last 2 months just been so ridiculous, you know?
I hear you. So how do people get in touch with you to get your newsletter? Because I think that people want to check this thing out.
Okay, you can go to thestreet.com. And punch in. So you can go. There's a link for Stocks Under 10, or you can email me personally at frank.curzio@thestreet.com. I do answer all my emails. And again, like I say with my podcast, I'm sure you say with yours, it's all in network.
Yep.
And you know, if you want to call me an idiot and say, Frank, you know what you're talking about, tell me why. You know, I think that it's all beneficial. There's people out there that are smarter than both of us, and it's good to get that network going and just say, hey, this is why I don't agree because of this, this, and this. And you know what? I've gotten those emails and turned around and said, you know what, you're right, that's a good point, and brought up my podcast. So it's all like a network to make us smarter. Hopefully it'll make us more money too.
Yeah, I hear you. So in closing, I just wanted to ask you one thing, because something I know that you interviewed somebody recently about. This, there's a new FASB ruling coming on board soon. You familiar with this?
Mm-hmm. FASB 140.
What's going on?
Well, it basically a rule that's kind of like under the radar right now, and let's see, it's probably going to get pushed out, but I think in the next couple of months, I had a guest on saying that the banks are going to have to transfer all of their off-balance assets onto their balance sheet, and that's supposed to happen by the year end. If that happens, you're talking about, you know, significant, well, I don't want to say significant losses, but more toxic assets on their books, which is going to be interesting. It's probably the reason why they're going over the stress test, and maybe the reason why you've seen six failures, and all six of them are protesting, saying, no way! Because they're really going into this, and I'm glad. I'm very, very happy that the Treasury, the Federal Reserve, the government is really taking this seriously, and it's not a PR event. It seems like they're really going after it and saying, listen, this is what you guys need to do in case unemployment goes to double digits. So it is interesting. Keep an eye on it. FASB 140, you can do your own research on it as well, but take a look at it. And I didn't know anything about it until a week and a half ago, and I had
it's the off-balance sheet securitized portfolios primarily that we used to that were packaged up and then put off. It's funny. You know what?
Yeah.
You know what's funny, Frank, in all of this? What really is funny? That if you think about the two drivers that demolished this whole market, it was derivatives and it was off-balance sheet, right? Wasn't that?
Well, we're still not that. We still haven't solved the derivative problem, and now we got the off balance
right.
going on the balance.
What's fascinating is, isn't this exactly what happened a dozen or so years ago that ruined the markets, and we swore we'd never do it again?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the kind of spooky thing. Anyway, hey, listen, I enjoy talking to you, Frank Curzio. Check him out over at thestreet.com. Get his stocks under. Do you got like a free trial for it or something, or how do you do that?
A free trial? Yes, you can go on it for a 30-day free trial again, or you can email it at frank.curzio@thestreet.com.
No, awesome. Hey, great. Listen, I will talk to you later, and we'll chat.
Thanks for having me on, bud.
Hey, Frank. Bye-bye. I'm very pleased today to have David Wheelock, who's the Assistant Vice President of the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis. This is great. This is a wonderful site. I'll put the link on our podcast show notes. But basically, a terrific site for economic research. And recently, David and a few people over there put out a... By the way, I get the weekly and the updates constantly to my emails. And he put out a great research piece called The Global Recession and discusses kind of where we are on a global basis. So I want to ask him some questions. David, how are you, buddy?
Very well, thank you.
So let's talk a little bit about how the global recession that we've been seeing seems almost to be in lockstep. In other words, each country around the world almost seems to be in a uniform recession. Have we ever seen something like that before?
Well, it's rather unusual. I did this research because one of my colleagues made the assertion that this was one of the first times that the whole world has been in recession at the same time. And I didn't believe it, frankly. But then I went back and looked, and lo and behold, it's pretty much the case that almost every country in the world is in recession. And at an aggregate level, there is a slowing of the world economy.
Now, I'm thinking for a moment, you know, we have the swine flu thing going on here. And, you know, one of the things that you look at is the spread of the swine flu. And what they're trying to do is bring it back to one central point to find who is the original host of the disease. Is that, since we have the same situation happening with a global economic pandemic, right? Are we able to trace it back to one particular area?
Well, certainly when you're talking about the global economy, the U.S. is still the world's leading economy, the largest economy. So the U.S. has a economic problem that's going to affect much of the rest of the world, clearly through our international trade as well as international capital flows. There are other points in the rest of the world where there are financial problems, Eastern Europe, for example, but I think a lot of the financial crisis that is a major factor in the recession occurred in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. And to kind of, I think, follow along with that, much of the global prosperity began with the U.S. or was at least advanced by the U.S.
Well, certainly the boom, the housing market boom in the U.S., there were some similar booms going on in other countries. But the U.S., was an engine of growth coming out of the 2000-2001 recession and attracted a lot of investment savings from abroad into the U.S. Real estate markets. And, that generated a lot of income and wealth here and a demand for products from all over the world.
So let's talk about a recession. So there's a couple different definitions of recession. The one that the thumbnail that everybody goes by is kind of, okay, two consecutive negative quarters of GDP growth. That's the kind of one everybody thinks about.
Right.
But there's another one by the ECRI, which is the Economic Cycle Research Institute, that has a little bit of a different definition. And can you just go through very quickly the two and what you think is more important?
Well, the one I'm more familiar with is the U.S. business cycle dating by the National Bureau of Economic Research. Or NBER, and they date the beginning of the current recession in the U.S. to December of 2007. Mm-hmm. But the U.S. economy, in terms of GDP, continued to expand through the first half of 2008, and we've only had negative GDP growth since the middle of 2008. The NBER and I think the ECRI also look at a variety of data, not just GDP, but they're looking at the employment growth, industrial production, a whole host of data in determining, when a country is in a recession or not, just beyond the standard rule of thumb definition. And, I'm not prepared to say that one is better than the other,
right.
But, they're just two alternative perspectives. But
and they're both confirming.
Both confirming, certainly for the U.S. and for many countries.
So now, the data that we're looking at recently, I've been very concerned about, because when you look at the data that's been coming out, we get a multitude of lines. We get what the consensus estimate was, what the prior was, what the actual was, and then the revision. And revisions have been quite remarkable of late. Have you noticed that in almost every economic release?
I didn't hear the entire question, but revisions to the data on GDP, for example?
Well, not only GDP, but almost every economic release that we're seeing, core release that is important, we're seeing significant revisions to, and oftentimes they're to the worse.
I guess I wouldn't put too much into the direction of a revision. It's not really uncommon for revisions to be, dramatically different from the initial estimate, because the revisions are, of course, based on more complete data. And so you'd expect there to be some changes, particularly in an environment like we have now where, there's a lot of volatility, not only in the financial markets, but in the economy as well. So I guess I don't view that as a big surprise.
But then, what we see are markets oftentimes reacting immediately to the release of economic data.
Right.
And then the question then obviously has to be asked is that a wise thing to do in the face of the fact that maybe revisions, and those revisions could be considerable?
Well, that's certainly true. I mean, the markets react to the best available data they have. And as you point out, sometimes those data are revised rather significantly, and then you get another mm-hmm. market reaction.
Right.
It is a period of unusual volatility in markets, and so, we're getting extreme movements based on even preliminary data. But, you'd be kind of surprised otherwise if markets weren't reacting to whatever news they do have.
Sure. I think they also react in the direction they want to be. You kind of pick up, right now we're in that whole green shoots mode.
Yeah.
And everybody is looking for any tidbit. It was kind of fascinating last week when we saw the GDP number come out at a -6, which you had a gasp when you saw that. That's pretty ugly back-to-back, those kind of numbers.
Yep.
And then all of a sudden to see such a positive response minutes, an hour later from the general markets, because they picked up, that inventories were crushed, thinking that they only had to get better.
Right.
And that personal consumption was looking a little bit better. So that's exciting, I suppose.
Yeah, you really have to pick apart the numbers and see what's behind them in order to get a sense of where we're headed next.
Yeah, so where are we heading? Well, let me ask you before I ask that question. It looks like the only country that's been able to escape a recession from the G7, I think I think Australia still is not, but is Canada. And how do they manage that? What is the differential?
Well, I'm certainly not an expert on Canada. I do know they've had much less in the way of banking and financial problems than the U.S. and many other countries mm-hmm. have had. I'm not sure that's the only factor affecting Canada. Of course, another factor in the recession, of course, was the run-up in oil prices and the world oil prices last summer. And so countries that are commodity-rich, like Canada, would tend to benefit from increase in commodity prices. So that's probably helped their economy as well.
Mm-hmm. At least stave it off for some time.
Exactly,
until,
yeah.
The fact is, I guess, if oil stays extraordinarily low, for example, and commodities stay low for a while, they could actually flip over.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
Exactly. All right, so do you also, I shouldn't ask, do you agree with some of these green shoots? I mean, we're seeing, a lot of it's not as bad as was. And one of the things that's fascinating to me is that when you look at a number, let's just say 100 was a number prior, and it goes down to 10, which is, a very big decline percentage-wise and a raw number. Mm-hmm. And now you see a number that comes out the next month that's a 12. Again, whatever that number is, it's a 20% increase, but it's still far from a 90.
Oh yeah.
I mean, should we be getting as excited now as we are?
Well, it's certainly better than it going down to 8.
No question.
So if you're seeing some stability and a little bit of upturn, the direction is at this point is important as the level.
Right.
So if you're getting some movements up and some data, those certainly you'd call those green shoots. I'm not an economic forecaster, mm-hmm. but the forecasts that I've been seeing suggest that, after the current quarter, we'll see the bottom, and then sometime in the second half of this year, the economy will start to grow.
Now, let me ask you this. So how is this for a possibility? If we're looking at that same scenario I mentioned before between a 100 and a 10, is it inevitable that the economy almost has to recover to positive growth, at least on a single quarter, as comparing to a horrific period a year prior when you're doing a comparison to comparison? Because if one period, again, was so just awful, you almost have to have a little bit of a pickup beyond that 1 to 2 quarters afterwards. And that's where you get that V recovery issue, which may not be an actual dollar for dollar recovery, but a percentage recovery is almost inevitable, isn't it?
Well, I'm not so sure that's the case. I mean, if we go back to looking at the 1930s, we had an awful lot of negative quarters in a row where things kept getting worse.
Right.
We're nowhere close to that kind of scenario. So I don't think it's inevitable that after even a large decline like we've seen in the last couple of quarters, that you necessarily have to see a positive percentage increase at that point. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, I think, what I'm reading in the forecast that I see, if, you know, I look at the private forecasts like everyone else does, and, most economists think that this recession is probably approaching its bottom, and maybe sometime in the second half of the year we'll start to see some positive numbers.
And last question in terms of the global recession. So now that we've seen that the global economies have essentially worked in lockstep, maybe a quarter off here or there, but generally speaking, you know, have entered the recession almost entirely together. Do you think that blows the idea of a global asset allocation strategy? And again, I'm not asking you to be pinpointed as an investment expert, but from the aspect of if you're looking to get diversification in equities and markets and in economies around the world, you have to scratch your head, I think, and wonder, you know, how do I get that at this point if everybody moves in tandem?
Well, that's certainly true. Throughout history, we've seen periods when international financial markets were more or less well integrated. In some periods, global stock markets move pretty closely together. In other periods, they diverge a bit. I think it's still the case that you can get some diversification benefits, even if one country's, even if most countries are sagging, you're still going to have some that aren't, and some markets will sag less than others. So there's still some benefits to be had from diversification.
Okay, well, that's good information. David Wheelock, Assistant Vice President for the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, a wonderful site that I encourage you to go to, research.stlouisfed.org, and check out. They have bukus of information, lots of great charts information, and bring it to you very, very quickly and have some great services to keep you updated by email, et cetera. I encourage you to read his report, The Global Recession, in the International Economic Trends, I guess it's a monthly that you put out, with all sorts of data to back it up. Thanks so much for joining us today, buddy.
You're very welcome.
All right, see you soon.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Well, thanks for joining me again on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. We'll be back next week with some great guests. And I also wanted to mention to you that we have all the information in the show notes over at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Just go right there and right on the top. It's usually right on the top position. Is the latest podcast is right there with all the links and all the information, the downloads that you can use and that you need right there, or that we want to provide for you. Also, on the left-hand side of the page, if you go down a little bit, there's a picture of me there. And beyond the picture of me right there, underneath that is a hyperlink right to the show notes for the latest episode. So check that out, and we'll see you again next week. Thanks for joining me on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Have a great week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.